So thanks for inviting me. I understand some of us are on a tight schedule, so I'll try to stick to 1 hour sharp. So before I forget them and don't have the time, let me show you just a totally artificial movie of the neural tube closing with specification of neurons, neuron bands, and these yellow cells. The AKITSCUTE and the Notch Delta pathways are all in action here, and so are the ligands and receptors, etc. This was published in 1998, by the way. So let me now start, and we'll see what the movie, where the movie comes from. I want to talk about some reflections on perturbation and stability in biological systems, since seen from a theorist's point of view, and these are collaborations of various times with various people. Now, stability and perturbation, these call to mind the words canalization in the case of developmental biologists, and the word mutation in the case of evolutionists. These are basically very different and opposite concepts in a way. Canalization is all about damping the noise in a biological system during its development, and mutation is all about amplifying genetic noise in a system. And the noise may have different origins in the two situations, not always. And what we want to really try and gauge is the relationship between these two. Different things. Canalization has been mostly to do with development, mutation with evolution, and how do they balance each other, and underlying all these is the question of the diversity of organisms. So I'm basically to deal with two examples. One is the remarkable transduction pathway, which is one of retinoic acid, and now how the level of retinoic acid in the nervous, in the formation of the nervous system may be interpreted at various levels. The other is the an evolutionary bifurcation, I would not call it a mutation really, how the formation of the central nervous system starting from the same genes can give rise to two very different morphologies. And if I have the time, I'll end up with a few short remarks about mutation and diversity. So let me start with retinoic acid. Retinoic acid is involved in the, may I remind you, I work in the neurobiology lab. So the retinoic acid is implicated in the morphogenesis of the central nervous system, in particular its rostrocaudal specification. If you treat an embryo with retinoic acid, you lose the forebrain, basically, and even the brain. And you can look at various markers and see that if you have basically you equip an embryo with a constitutionally weakened retinoic acid receptor, you get increased size of the forebrain structures. And if you equip it with a function with a constitutionally active receptor, you get a diminished size of the forebrain structures. Retinoic acid is also involved in the control of the number of neurons and the location of these neurons. Here is a normal embryo with three stripes of neurons. We shall come back to that. The motor neurons, the interneurons, and the central neurons, all of them come in three stripes, at least in the Xenopus embryo. If you treat the embryo with or increase somehow retinoic acid signaling, you get an increase in the number of neurons and the merging of these bands. And on the converse is also true if you reduce retinoic acid signaling. Now, why did I choose this pathway for a computational treatment? Is because it has, among all the morphologically important, morphogenetically important
substances, a remarkable property is that its transduction pathway is remarkably simple, quote-unquote, because the receptors for retinoic acid signaling are nuclear proteins, so they sit in the nucleus, actually bound to the DNA most of the time. And retinoic acid is assumed to be able to reach these in ways that are not entirely clear, actually. So the first of all, in this important in the transduction pathway are the response elements for retinoic acid. There's basically two types. This is a vast simplification of something which is a lot more complicated already. But you have these response elements are direct repeats, as is often the case. With one base pair spacing, you have what's called the DR1. The DR1 can bind essentially two different types of subtypes of receptor, or of families of receptors. One is the RAR family, another is the RXR family. On the DR1, you can bind an RXR dimer. And when this is bound with retinoic acid, you get an activation of transcription. When, on the other hand, you have an RAR bound upstream and an RXR downstream, you have an inhibition of transcription on these response elements. On the other hand, you have a second type of response, which is a DR5, five base pair spacings. In this case, the active conformation is different. RAR is binding downstream towards the target gene, RXR upstream, and this conformation is the only one possible and leads to activation of transcription. So there's quite a bit of combinatorial richness here because you have different receptor subtypes and you have different response elements, and basically you can play. I mean, there is an additional twist to this story, which is the following. I've drawn here a retinoic acid gradient. I mean, it's still controversial whether in the rostrocaudal direction the embryo exhibits a retinoic acid gradient. There are certain differences in levels of signaling. This is all that is actually known, and the actual gradient is not something quite clear. One interesting twist is that one of the receptor subtypes, the RAR, has in its promoter a DR5 response element. Okay, so this is the conformation. And so when there is enough retinoic acid, you tend to make more retinoic acid receptor of a particular subtype. So there's an interesting feedback loop here. Now, the modeling approach I've taken to this problem, like all the others I'm going to talk about later on, is not one of exhausting the parameter space or searching in parameter space. It is instead one which is, I tend to think, is more akin to what the biologists do, which is to work for a particular problem on a particular preparation. So my computer preparation is something that basically is usually, and it will is bound to be for quite a while, an incomplete description. And it is built with a sense, you know, gathered in conversations and from the literature of what counts in that description. And it is, of course, progressively refined. So that's just a scientific method in a way. And the approach consists in describing molecular processes locally in space and time. And at a given point in the cell or in the extracellular medium, basically, and at a given moment, you assume simple kinetic laws, mass action laws, and so on and so forth. And everything that happens is basically stochastic, be it reactions among proteins, binding of promoters to DNA, and so on and so forth, activation of gene transcription. It is all entirely in stochastic terms. And because you talk about points, there is a transition time between point to point, and so delays are built into the system from the beginning. And as far as the spatial structure of the system is concerned, you've seen the picture of the tube. Basically, this is it's a computer screen with pixels, which are hexagonal little arrays. These are not the cells of Gary O'Dell. These are now bits of a cell that can compose, for example, nuclei. and membranes and cytoplasm and signals being transferred from one to the other, and the cells can move basically by acquiring pixels or losing them. And they can also be, if you are, for example, modeling an epithelium, they can be bound by sharp, they can be sometimes linked by things like junction adherents or desmosomes and so on and so forth. And in this particular case, basically, there is very little spatial structure except that you have nuclei with DNA and transcription factors sitting on it. And I just, to give you a feel, you have basically locally reaction mechanisms, which are mass action laws between receptor and response elements E. The response elements, the receptor on the response element can bind retinoic acid. All this is reversible. You have a probability that a particular promoter is going to be occupied by an active or inactive pair of receptors, and as a function of this, you stochastically activate gene transcription or not. Now, as I said, you have two types, basically, broadly speaking, two types of receptors, two types of response elements. So you have basically four combinatorial possibilities, and I'm not going to talk about the simple ones. Well, or they're all interesting, but I'm not going to talk about them. I just want to talk about a particular combination where you, of course, we know that retinoic acid is that the response in terms of retinoic acid receptor is determined by a DR5 element. Now we put in here a reporter gene which is controlled by a DR1 element, and I've put here a graded distribution. It doesn't have to be a gradient, it's just a way of sampling the response of cells to various levels of retinoic acid. Basically, you have between this point and this point a factor 10 in terms of concentration of retinoic acid. Basically, what you see is as you start the system, the high levels of retinoic acid are going to activate transcription of the reporter gene, but this will be shut down by higher levels because there is a competition between various types of receptors binding to various places on the response element, and you can sharpen this very much to a readout of the level of retinoic acid on the order of 5%, basically 5%, and in the case of this particular gradient, this leads to a one cell wide control of transcription. And you can ask yourself, as a theorist, you want to really understand what is the source of this stability. And in this particular case, we'll have other examples later on today, but in this particular case, it's quite easy to trace the reproducibility and the stability of the response to the following fact. In signaling by retinoic acid, you have basically the RXR family, which is sort of ubiquitously expressed. And RAR is the only one which is variable in this system. And there is this loop of making more RAR when you have more RA. Now the loop can function as much as you want, basically, and build a large stock of RAR with no consequence whatsoever on the system, because in order to be functional, RAR must combine with an RXR. The dimeric nature, the heterodimeric nature of the transcription factor is really what makes this system highly robust. I mean, you can shake the thing quite a bit, change the level of RAR in the system, and nothing will actually happen, because everything is controlled, in large part, everything is controlled by the level of an ubiquitous factor. So I want now to go on to a second sort of, I've just discussed now something related to stability, and I've tried to give you an idea for the sort of mechanism that may lead to stability in signaling by retinoic acid. Let me move now to the second aspect of my talk, which has to do with the not canalization but mutation, that is the generation of different morphologies from what is may apparently be not so big genetic changes. Well, this is something that yes, and of course you can. I mean, I could show you the same thing done 1,000 times, and it will not look quite exactly the same, but pretty much the same. Okay, so that is just the dimension of the embryo, no matter what it is. Okay, and this you can think of it as the rostrocaudal axis. But as I told you, I mean, it's not at all evident that there is such a nice smooth gradient of retinoic acid in the embryo.
And you understand why it's a sort of non-monotonic response at the end of the day, that high retinoic acid shut off the other one and low retinoic acid. Low retinoic acid shutting is not okay.
Okay, so what happens basically is that at the high end, okay, all combinations are basically, I mean, you turn on the RAR gene. Okay, so you have a lot of
so there's lots of RAR.
There's a lot of RAR. Okay, now RAR will basically ultimately come in on the DR1 reporter. On the reporter gene controlled by the DR1 will ultimately come and compete with the RXR homodimer, and this will shut down transcription basically. That is the mechanism behind this. On the other hand, there is no retinoic acid, so the little black dots aren't there and there is no signaling.
I always thought that there are some cofactors for the system which are required, which can alter the way.
Yes, absolutely. No, the system, it's a lot more complicated than that. This is a version that I took out, you know, for pedagogical purposes, basically. I mean, it's not just to make the point about how you may build or not build stability in this system. The fact is that, of course, there's a lot more complication known by now to this transduction pathway. Still, it remains one of the simplest ones that we can, in terms of, you know, what we can think of. But of course, the role of the you can build progressive refinements of this, and we have done so we've started doing so very recently, putting in what is now known about the many cofactors in this system. So the formation of the neural tube is the formation of central nervous system is what I shall take as the illustration of varying morphogenesis in the evolutionary on an evolutionary time scale. Now, in vertebrates, this picture taken from Lewis's textbook shows, the formation of the central nervous system. This is not something that physicists would usually think of as a central nervous system, which is just a tube actually, forming on our back and progressively invaginating and closing off itself off. This process is known as neurulation, and it takes place in an inhomogeneous fashion along the length of the embryo. In the case of invertebrates, the situation is very different. First of all, everything happens on the belly and not on the back of the animal, so it's all here. The neuroectoderm, which is never going to invaginate, this is just after gastrulation, is not going to invaginate, but instead you have select cells in this neuroectoderm that will delaminate from this epithelium and make go and generate ganglia, which are structures, discrete structures, no longer a continuous structure like a tube, but discrete structures. If you look at the animal from above, what you see is that basically you have these discrete cells, neuroblasts, that will come out and form the ganglia in a way that is structured by the segmental boundaries. So it's extremely different. However, over the past 10 years or thereabouts, people have analyzed the genetic basis for the formation of the central nervous system in insects like Drosophila and invertebrates like Xenopus. And what they have found is that the genes involved in this process are essentially homologous in the two cases and function in basically homologous signaling pathways. And the question I want to ask is really, how do you manage to build from, well, first of all, the story might be a lot more complicated in the chick, but I don't want to get into that. How can you possibly manage to construct such different structures, a continuous tube versus discrete ganglia, out of a genetic system which is essentially homologous in the two cases? So let me first describe the genes involved, and we've already heard the names of some of them earlier on. So let me take the vertebrate language, since anyways the genes are the same in both cases. On invertebrates, you have a Spemann's organizer, or the notochord, which secretes a number of factors which induce the formation of the neural tube. And this induction actually works by lifting an endogenous inhibition by BMP of a certain number of genes that are characteristic of dorsal structures. So it's minus times minus gives plus, basically. And as you lift the BMP inhibition, you start expressing, this again depends on your position on the rostrocaudal axis, a number of genes that are characteristic of the neural plate, as it is called. And on this neural plate, a number of activities are present. In particular, many of the cells are expressing something called Notch, which is a receptor for a molecule we shall call a bit later, talk about just now, which is delta. There is also the progressive refinement of these three families of, at least in the case of Xenopus, of neurons. I shall look only at those neurons, which are the motor neurons, which would be the most ventral ones, as this plate will invaginate. So this was for the external regulation of this system. There are extensive cellular networks involved in the differentiation of the neural plate and then the neurons themselves. There are a certain number of genes, homeogenes, characteristic of the neural plate, and a number of genes characteristic of neurons, among those AKIT-SKEWT, already mentioned, which interacts in complex ways with members of the enhancer of split family to basically stabilize by generating these switches. This is a hypothetical mechanism for which there is quite a bit of experimental support. You have basically the generation of these AKIT-SKEWT on neurons, or AKIT-SKEWT off non-neuronal cells in the nervous system. So there's another such switch involved in the stabilization of the neural plate. These switches basically they function as cellular memories. In other words, they will stabilize the fate of cells as they have been as they are thrown by various morphogens. In addition, there are intercellular genetic networks in this system. There is the dorsalizing activity of the lowered BMP gradient. There is sonic hedgehog, which is also expressed in the notochord, which comes to activate the neuronal fate in yellow here. Neuronal fate means that you manufacture, among other things, that you manufacture delta, the ligand for Notch, which is ubiquitous, and the function of this pathway, which is repeats itself in various guises, is in this particular case to ensure a degree of lateral inhibition, in the sense that when delta binds to its receptor Notch, the net result of this activity is that delta, AKT-skewed, all the neuronal genes, including delta, will be shut off in neighboring cells, meaning that among a number of cells which all express delta, the one that expresses delta at the highest level can be pictured as winning out slowly over the ones that express delta at a lower level, because the more delta you make, the stronger the inhibition is on your neighbors. Notch and delta do work like this in this particular context, probably, but they can work in different ways in different contexts, so I don't want to present this as a general feature of the Notch-delta pathway. And in order to actually do simulations, you have to say something about the mechanical properties of cells and about their motility. And this is really, this was, when we did this work in 98, was very problematic, because people were all very enthusiastic about all these genes being the same, and they had not really looked at what happened inside cells to generate the diversity of fates that may ensue once you are genetically determined. And we had to figure out, first of all, that was simple enough, that, you know, since you work in a neural epithelium here, you need to anchor these cells to one another in a very strong way. So these are junctions of desmosome or junction adherence type of things. These junctions have an important role beyond the mechanical role of anchoring cells together, which is to differentiate, to be instruments of a potential difference between the two sides of the cells, the apical side, which is above in this picture, and the basal side. The type of motion since very little was known about motion, we took an engineering sort of approach, and the engineering approach told us, look, if you want to really make an invaginating plate, what you need is some sort of contraction on the apical side and some sort of tendency to expansion in the basal side of these cells. And the question remained, what about the genetic control of these differential motions? And let me first show you what happens when you assume that, you know, among these two basic genetic identities, neural plate, neural tissue, or neuron, when you first assume that it is the neural plate identity gene which plays the major role in controlling the motion.
Sorry. Yes. I'm lost. I mean, I'm just misunderstanding, but why can't you just pull these two red things in? So what's different? What exactly are you imagining here?
What we are imagining is that, you know, there is the cell cortex on the two sides has different properties. It is known to have by now to have indeed different properties in terms of cytoskeletal composition. But what we assume is that there is a tendency for this cortex to basically contract on one side of the cell and to expand on the other side of the cell. This sort of mechanism could be, this is what we assumed here, but of course the same sort of effect could be obtained in a variety of ways.
Yes.
The major point being, what is it that controls this this motion?
So if the volume of the cell is conserved, then if the apex contracts, the basal end has to stretch. In other words, let's suppose the basal end has no particular tendencies at all.
Mm-hmm.
If you constrict the apical face of the cell, volume conservation will push out the other end.
Yes, I mean, if you Indeed. Well, if you assume something then about the properties of the inside of the cell, of course.
Just that it's incompressible and it doesn't leak out.
Yeah, sure. No, it indeed, you can, you know, it basically, it doesn't work quite as well if you suppress one of these elements, but ultimately it will work the same as far as end result is concerned. The result is actually the following. So you have morphogens coming out of a source here, and we're not going to deal with the complications of the propagation of some of these morphogens. That's for the next talk, I assume. Basically, it's a simple diffusion in that particular case. When we did this work, very little was known about the way these morphogens actually propagate. So there is this lower level of inhibition near the midline. There is this high level of sonic hedgehog signaling also near the midline. And basically what you see is that starting with a uniform layer of cells, you quickly turn on the genes characteristic of the neural plate. Let me call them the green genes. And you then turn on genes. This is the work of sonic hedgehog and also of the green gene. You then turn on the genes characteristic of the of neurons. There's initially an overexpression, and then lateral inhibition comes in, the new notch delta phenomenon, to basically restrict expression to single neuronal precursors. All the while, I mean, at about this time, basically, the expression of the source of morphogens can be turned off. There is no need for them anymore. The states of the cells are determined autonomously, and the differential levels, the differential motions that we have assumed lead to the formation of this tube that progressively closes. Mitosis taking place on the sides generate a push, an additional push that helps in the closing of the tube. Now, I'm not going to talk about the variety of experiments we've done, because the formation of the tube is not an easy problem, neither for computer programmers nor for biology. One birth in 200, approximately, is spina bifida, meaning that the tube does not succeed to close. And there's a variety, one birth in 200, yes. And probably about a third of spontaneous abortions are due to failures to close the neural tube as well. So it's really a very difficult problem. And retinoic acid, for example, certainly plays a role in this system. I mean, one of the things that is recommended to pregnant women is to take a lot of vitamin A, precisely to avoid this type of thing. Vitamin A is a precursor, a metabolic precursor of retinoic acid. In particular, there is, I don't have the pictures to show you because working under time pressure, I just decided not to show these pictures to you, but I can show them to you later on if you wish. Basically, the rate of cell divisions in these two tissues, so the lateral ectoderm and the neuroectoderm, plays a major role. I mean, if you have too many divisions in this tissue, there's just too much of a mass of cells that you don't manage to join and close. If there's too little, you have different sort of problems, and a variety of these problems. For example, there is a very one of the major causes of failure of closing of the one of the major genetic causes for failure to close neural tube is Wardenburg syndrome, which is basically a mutation which affects the rate of mitosis in neural tissue. So we tend to agree with nature here that it's not easy to close the neural tube. Oops. What's this? This is just a larger picture of what you see here. the movie you have seen. What happens here? Okay. No, no, but I don't want to show you the movie. I would like to go further. Okay. Okay. So, of course, in evolution, there's been a lot of tinkering. We have been told this repeatedly. We have to do a bit better than that because we don't have millions of years. So, we try to look at what happened when basically we switched the mechanical control of this system from the from being mostly mostly under these green genes or neural plate genes influence to being more under the influence of the neuronal genes. And what you see in this case is that genetically, I mean, as far as genetic activities is concerned, it's all exactly the same as before. You have the progressive, the first, the generation of the neural neuroectoderm, then the generation, the overgeneration of neurons, then there the precise the definition of the neuronal territories. But now, since the motion is restricted to the neuronal cells, what you see is that instead of a large plate invaginating, the whole tissue deforming itself, it is individual cells that tend to delaminate and form these neuroblasts that will then go on to generate the ganglia. And this, of course, I said ganglia because indeed we have here something which is very similar to the neurogenesis in early neurogenesis in insects. So basically, what we are proposing here is a testable mechanism which tells us a testable hypothesis, which is the following. In vertebrates, a number of genes have been linked to control of cell motion. In invertebrates, another set of genes has been linked to cell motion, has been controlling cell motion. These two pathways have diverged to a large extent, and this is something that you can possibly test in a variety of ways. One way is the following. In the formation of the nervous system, people are examining the effect of a variety of experiments, such as, for example, the local application by electroporation of a certain number of molecules that would disrupt motion, cell motion. And by disrupting cell motion in various places in the neural tube as it is formed, you can get phenotypes that are basically very comparable to these, either to these ganglia or to sort of blobs like the tube. So the sort of mechanism we are dealing with is, we are hypothesizing, can be tested. You can get either these blobs or discrete ganglia. This is in an animal which normally forms a tube, and on the already formed tube as it goes on moving. So that's one sort of test which is actually taking place in the lab and in two other labs at the Pasteur at this moment, and helps. It is a help in interpreting phenotypes of observed in actual experiments. There is an interesting, of course, there's an evolutionary aspect here, and in this respect, it's probably interesting to note, I mean, this was pointed out to me some time ago by a paleontologist, that there is by now, our mechanism basically says there is not a large difference between neural tube and ganglia in terms of genetic makeup. And certainly evolution has stabilized one or the other in extant animals. This is a beast that lived something like 450 million years ago in China. And it has a bit of a notochord, of something that paleontologists interpret as a notochord on this side. And it has something like ganglia, or what is interpreted as ganglia, on the other side. I'm not an expert, so I cannot really give you more details on this interpretation, but it seems that there may have been, there may existed animals where the two types of morphogenesis coexisted at some point, but this was probably a rather unstable situation which was quickly driven out. The bar here is a half millimeter, a millimeter, sorry. So, and the whole animal, and so, yeah. There it is, sorry. There is also, there are animals today that show a very, an intermediate sort of, something very close to a transition line between having ganglia and having a notochord, and therefore being chordates with a vertebrate type nervous system. One of them is Ciona intestinalis, whose genome has just been sequenced, and it will be interesting to see among the genes involved in neurogenesis in this beast which ones are actually in control of the formation of the cell motion and cytoskeletal components. This would be more of a bioinformatic type of analysis then, to try and get an experimental handle on this hypothetical type of mechanism. Now, I would like briefly to finish by presenting some thoughts and results about the nature of, we've talked about canalization in one particular pathway, we've talked about mutation and or lack of canalization in a different situation. I would like to present something which is very closely related to what Gary O'Dell just told us. As he mentioned, basically in this segmentation network, there have been duplications, and really the sort of, I mean, apart from the sort of noise that has been put into our simulations, which is, you know, stochastic gene activation, of which Claude Desplan was talking, and cell motions, of which there is a lot, by the way, during segmentation, and some of these cell motions during segmentation actually transport, it is known that they transport, for example, wingless with them. So apart from all these sources of noise, not all of which we have looked at, I have been interested in seeing what the potential consequences of the invected and grailed duplication are. And this is actually quite subtle. I did this partly in reaction to something, to the arguments of population geneticists, who basically say, look, if you have two copies of a gene, well, one of them must go away if it's not needed for anything. It will just decay and disappear. It's not quite as simple as that once you take... Whoops.
Do you know there are pathways where both are used together?
Well, during segmentation, invected is basically not expressed very much, but later on, during the same set of genes, is basically reused in a background where it is already active, in order to generate the, for example, in the butterfly, generates the eye spots of butterflies.
And, you know it's infected, that's also
and their infected is important, yes. So So, but I mean, we're currently looking at, you know, the mystery of how you can reuse a pathway, a genetic pathway, all the while in a background of cells which are also using this pathway to do different things. It's really quite intricate. So you can generate, using the sort of formalism we use, basically a stable segmental structure of this type. So you see cell shapes are all, you know, wiggly-woggly. I mean, there is a you have the standard engrailed wingless or hedgehog wingless type of activation pattern. By the way, these are not tori. These are really, I mean, these are closed off here at the ends. Now, this is with two copies, two identical copies of, assuming that Invected is a perfect copy of Engrail. Ah. Now, if you assume that the duplication, as we actually know, was not a perfect duplication, and Invected has lost a bit which is actually responsible for a particular intracellular interaction, well, then you just wait. If you wait the same amount of time during which this has been stably staying put, what you see is that a lot of a disaster has occurred. And this is just assuming that the second copy of Engrailed, the Invected copy of Engrailed, is an imperfect one.
What is yellow and red?
Red is expressing hedgehog and or Engrailed, and green is expressing wingless.
And
yellow is expressing both.
Both hedgehog and Engrailed.
That's right.
And Invected is not.
Well, I mean, the Engrailed and Invected, sorry about that, I should have said it, they are expressing the same pattern, basically, since they have they share the same, they have the same promoter, so they are perfect duplications. However, if you put a large intron in Invected, and we know there is a large intron in the Invected gene, then this means that the transcription of Invected will take a long time. And when it does take a long time, you get back to this situation. Okay? So, as Garrett said, he was suspecting that delays have a strong stabilizing influence on genetic networks. And I can confirm this by saying that certainly if you add, adding delays, usually as a very beneficial effect on the functioning of these networks. So I just want to finish off now with a remark that's sort of in between the two themes, between canalization and mutation. You have, of course, the problem of the diversity of living organisms. And this is a remark aimed more at physicists and at biologists who basically sort of know these things. But the amount of potential diversity in biological systems is simply stupendous. Okay, there is you cannot underestimate the diversity of the systems you are looking at. And this is an example taken from work from Kim Kaiser's lab in Scotland. It concerns an organ of Drosophila, which is the Malpighian tubule. Basically, this organ consists of a few hundreds of cells, and they can be basically all identified on a genetical basis. The way this is done is using enhancer trap lines, where a reporter gene, which changes the color of cells, is inserted in the genome at random locations. Okay. Now, as soon as two of these enhancer trap lines would light up the gene the reporter gene in different cells, you know that these two cells are not in the same genetic state. And basically, what Kaiser's collaborators have done is map a series of, they have found enough enhancer trap cultured enough enhancer trap lines, bred them, to find that basically you can find for each cell a unique pattern of genetic, pattern of genetic activity in this cell. So among a few hundred of these cells, each of them can be singled out as having a unique genetic state. So that the amount of diversity available for the generation of mutation is really, really enormous and should never be underestimated. So in all these discussions about stability versus instability of development, or mutation versus canalization, you should never lose sight of the fact that these networks working inside cells have been tested under a variety, an enormous variety of conditions, since all these cells are doing exactly what they should be doing, but they all do it in their own particular way, in a sense.
So you're saying Lewis was actually right?
Yes.
Yes, I do think Lewis is right. Yes. And actually, you know, look, I think physicists know this. 2 to the n, you know, if you just take it, is a large number. Is a large number, meaning that, and this is my last slide, basically, if you take, this is now the mouse forebrain, and I've mapped a few of the genes whose expression patterns are known in this system. This is data from the laboratory of Puelles. And if you superpose these expression maps, what you see is that you have a parcellation which, you know, even with these 8 genes, already goes into the tens of territories, basically. And so you can safely assume that this cell here, and I've taken the same colors, I've used the 5-color theorem to my advantage, so that, you know, this territory is different from this one, is different from this one, from this one. And basically, the amount of potential variation is very large. This is something I wanted to say because there's a lot of confusion. You see, people will say, well, combinatorial richness, but they don't realize what it actually means. And this is what it actually means. And on the other hand, people will say, well, there is not enough genes to wire the brain. And I think there's more than enough genes to wire the brain completely. With 50 genes working in an on and off manner, you can basically label uniquely each synapse. Okay? So the power of the genes is absolutely enormous. And on this note, which you may think optimistic or pessimistic, I will stop. Thank you for not interrupting. So I'm just in time.